and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, longtime Republican Party operative Roger Stone was arrested in a pre-dawn FBI raid on his home in Florida this morning. He was charged with 7 felonies, including witness tampering, obstruction of justice, and 5 counts of making false statements. Stone was arraigned in federal court at 11 o'clock this morning, and his attorney said he would fight the charges vigorously. Then Venezuela's judicial, political, and military leaders backed President Nicolas Maduro yesterday as the U.S.-backed coup attempt continued. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged member countries of the Organization of American States to back Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as president and refused to accept the decision by Maduro to expel the U.S. embassy staff. Street mobilizations by supporters of the government are continuing in the face of violence by opposition supporters. Next, Marzia Hashemi, the American citizen who's a journalist for Iran's Press TV, was released from federal custody after testifying before a grand jury. Hashemi had been held without charge as a material witness to force her testimony. She was subject to a variety of degradations while being held. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the Mueller investigation. Longtime Republican Party operative Roger Stone was arrested in a pre-dawn FBI raid on his home in Florida this morning. He was charged with 7 felonies, including witness tampering, obstructing a federal investigation, and 5 counts of making false statements. Stone was arraigned in federal court today at 11 o'clock, and his attorneys said he would fight the charges vigorously. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. His commentary is published on his website, thepolemicist.net, Counterpunch, and other online journals. Welcome back, Jim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jim, friends of Roger Stone's have said that he expected to be arrested all week. He's been in his house for the entire week, just waiting for the FBI to come in. They finally did at 6 o'clock this morning, banging on the door in full military gear with bulletproof vests and helmets and, for whatever reason, camouflage uniforms. But they got him. And he was arraigned. He was released on $250,000 signature bond and then gave a very spirited press conference outside the federal courthouse. He denied having committed any crimes. He said he would not bear false witness against Donald Trump, but he seemed to be enjoying himself too. What's up with this? What's up with Roger Stone with these charges? Is this serious?
Well, it's going to be serious for him, I guess, if, they push these charges, and I think they are going to push the charges. He has an attitude. He's always had an attitude that is quoted as saying, as I've always said, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. So, you know, he kind of relishes the drama. He's, I guess, a protege of Roy Cohn, another guy who he might have introduced Trump to Cohn. Cohn is one of the slimiest creatures in American politics. And Roger Stone himself was a self-styled dirty trickster, part of the Nixon Dirty Tricks campaign. So he's a guy who shouldn't be taken as a reliable character and is, you know, likes this kind of drama as the trickster and the, you know, guy skirting around the law. So he's going to play this up, I think, unless his lawyers get him to shut up.
We're going to listen to a little clip of Roger Stone at this raucous press conference. It's raucous because anti-Roger Stone people are chanting, and it's kind of hard to hear. But it's, I want to actually have our audience listen to his words, and then we'll talk about him and what he's doing, what his goal is right now. And also, I want to be able to spend some amount of time sort of dissecting what this indictment is, because the media is treating this as kind of proof positive again of collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. In fact, there's nothing in this indictment about that. But let's listen to this audio clip. Roger Stone's press conference. Again, there's lots of noise in the background, lots of ambient noise because people are chanting against him. But let's listen.
As I have always said, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. After a 2-year inquisition, the charges today relate in no way to Russian collusion, WikiLeaks collaboration, or any other illegal act in connection with the 2016 campaign. I am falsely accused of making false statements during my testimony to the House Intelligence Committee. That is incorrect. Any error I made in my testimony party would be both immaterial and without intent.
Okay, let's talk about that. He's saying what he's basically indicted for is not telling the truth, not to the Mueller probe, but to the House Intelligence Committee, who he was defiant in. He went to the House Intelligence Committee when he was subpoenaed, and he said, this is a witch hunt. There's nothing here. He was angry with them. He was kind of in their face. And at the same time, they asked him, do you have beforehand with the subpoena and at the hearing, do you have any emails? Do you have any text messages relevant to the discussions that we're having today? And he said, no, he said none. And then he reiterated that when he got in front of the hearing. Now he's indicted today because the Mueller investigation said he did have emails and texts. In other words, it's not about what the content is really of the emails and texts, but the fact that he had them and he said he didn't have them. When you actually read what the emails and texts say, Jim Kavanaugh, at least the ones that are listed in the indictment, it appears that Roger Stone is hoping that somebody from WikiLeaks will tell him that there's going to be an email dump of emails that are embarrassing to Hillary Clinton so that he can go back and tell the Trump campaign that he's the guy. He's the guy who is an inside source with WikiLeaks, and that makes him important. That makes him relevant. And he even complains in one of the emails, and this is cited in the indictment, that no one from the Trump campaign or the people in the Trump campaign he's reaching out to won't even call him back. And then he makes the argument, which we just heard, that if he didn't tell the exact truth to the House Intelligence Committee about the fact that he had emails or texts, it was, as he put it, either immaterial or without intent. Go ahead, Jim Kavanaugh.
Well, those last points are going to have to be adjudicated in the trial. But the general point is absolutely correct. What he's being indicted for are crimes that happened only in the process of the investigation. That did not happen outside the investigation, would not have happened without the investigation, and have no relevance really to anything as far as we can see outside. They do not have anything to do with Russian collusion. They do not have anything to do something that would be impeachable for Donald Trump even, unless Donald Trump is the senior campaign official mentioned here, which is doubtful. But, you know, again, these are process crimes. Exactly. They're crimes that occurred and emerged or were produced in the process of the investigation. So that's the case. And, you know, you read these things, and clearly he was trying to become the guy for the Trump campaign getting information from WikiLeaks, which he didn't have. And he was trying to use Randy Credico, who I guess is person number two, in order to do this. And he was trying to induce Randy Credico to say things that weren't true, maybe. You know, that's what one of the things that Mueller's going to get him on. But, you know, the guy was one of the things the indictment says is that on June 14th, the DNC announced that they knew they had been broken into. So from that time on, everybody in the world knew something was coming from somebody. And what campaign wouldn't want to find out about that? So, and he was trying to present himself and get himself in a position where he was the guy who was going to find out what was coming on behalf of the Trump campaign. And it was kind of pathetic and, you know, sleazy little dirty trick thing that he wasn't even very successful about. But they're not indicting him for that, as you say. They're indicting him for not being completely honest about that in speaking about it to the committee. So it's all process crimes and, you know, not telling the truth to the committee. But these have nothing to do with the substance of the Mueller investigation, which is Russian collusion, although the headlines and the first graphs of everything make it sound like that. The first graph of the Times article today is really, you know, Roger Stone, a longtime informal advisor to President Trump, was charged as part of the special counsel investigation over his communication with WikiLeaks, the organization behind the release of the thousands of stolen Democratic emails. So they're trying to make him part of WikiLeaks. He himself says, I communicated with WikiLeaks indirectly. He was presenting himself as having direct communications with Assange when he didn't. So, but what the stories are trying to say, this is the big one. This is the one that's really important. The indictment that's going to turn everything around. It's not going to turn anything around. It's going to fade away.
Yeah. And Julian Assange said that he had and WikiLeaks had no direct contact whatsoever with Roger Stone. That's what WikiLeaks has been saying. Now, John, you'll remember back and Jim Kavanaugh, we'll all remember back that everybody knew there was going to be another release by WikiLeaks in early October that was going to be with Clinton emails and it was going to be damaging to Clinton emails.
Correct.
Everybody knew it was coming. Matter of fact, the Democrats were, I believe, preparing for it too, because when WikiLeaks actually released this, which was October 7th, right, 2016, these embarrassing emails from the Podesta campaign and Hillary Clinton's campaign, that day is when the Access Hollywood tape was released. In other words, that was the tape that revealed that Donald Trump was bragging to
Billy Bush
that he liked to abuse women, that he liked to grab women. It was this gross, vulgar admission of Donald Trump being taped without him actually knowing he was being taped. It was an old tape. But clearly, everyone knew WikiLeaks was going to make this dump, this email dump. The Democrats were preparing for it. They countered it with the Access Hollywood tape. That's what I thought happened, because it sort of overwhelmed the story about the WikiLeaks release. So then here you have, in the run-up to that, Roger Stone saying, trying to convince the Trump campaign, which doesn't seem to care much about Roger Stone, I'm the guy who's going to tell you WikiLeaks is going to make an email dump, when in fact the entire world already knew these facts to be true. That's really what happened.
Yeah, he was trying to find out what it was going to be and say, and be the one who was going to tell the Trump campaign exactly what day it was going to happen and what was going to be in it. And he couldn't get that information because he didn't have direct access to WikiLeaks. And he was trying to make himself important then. He likes the idea of being important. The Mueller investigation has made him important now, I mean, at least for 20 minutes. And the press is going on about how important he is. Now, if you follow the little hint, sure, there's no specific collusion proved here and there's no specific charges against Trump. But if you follow the hints in here, maybe that will create certain links that we'll find out later. This is always what goes on in these things. And it's really kind of boring and I'm tired of it.
And this is what the government always wants. They just want us to take their word for it. They'll just say something and they want us to take their word for it. We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim's commentary is published on his website, thepolemicist.net, and also in Counterpunch and other online journals. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Venezuela's judicial, political, and military leaders backed President Nicolas Maduro yesterday as the U.S.-backed coup attempt continued. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged member countries of the Organization of American States to back Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as president and refused to accept the decision by Nicolas Maduro to expel the U.S. embassy staff. Street mobilizations by supporters of the government are continuing in the face of violence by opposition supporters. We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's an anti-war and anti-torture activist who is the co-founder of Code Pink. Welcome back, Medea.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Medea, you participated in an action yesterday at the Organization of American States. Tell us about that. And was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo there when you were there?
Yes, he was giving his talk and justifying U.S. intervention and telling how illegitimate the Maduro government is, as he is supporting the illegitimate presidency or attempted presidency of Juan Guaido. And so I managed to get up on a chair with my banner that said, OAS, don't support the coup in Venezuela, and started talking about the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America and the importance of the other countries in Latin America to not go along with this violation of another nation's sovereignty.
I was kind of stunned. First of all, congratulations on your action. I saw it. I was just about to leave this studio and go to a protest at the White House where you were also there, and it was pouring rain and it was cold. But just right before that, there you were. I saw the photo of you up on that chair in the middle of the OAS meeting. I thought, like, wow, how does she do it? I mean, it was really, really important, I think, to do it and to show resistance and to show opposition. Mike Pompeo said these words, and they're incredible when you hear them because of the level of imperial arrogance. He said, quote, and this is to the OAS, former President Nicolas Maduro does not have the legal authority to break diplomatic relations with the United States or to declare our diplomats persona non grata. That's Pompeo speaking yesterday to the OAS that you disrupted. I mean, you can't really top that in terms of imperial arrogance.
No, not at all. It was really disgusting to be there listening to him and to see the smirk on his face when I got up to intervene, like, oh, you know, ha-ha. I think it harkens back to the days when the U.S. thought that it could do whatever it wanted in Latin America before the, quote, pink tide. But I think Latin America has changed, and even people who don't like Maduro certainly don't want to see the U.S. intervening and organizing, orchestrating coups in Latin America.
And there have been so many, and I think it's important to remind people of that. I mean, we had the overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala in 1954 because it dared to nationalize the United Fruit Company
That's
plantations.
Right.
We had the overthrow of the government in the Dominican Republic in the mid-60s. The U.S. Marines invaded. We had the overthrow of the Chilean socialist government, which tried to introduce socialism peacefully and through legislative means. Allende was killed and 30,000 others were killed after September 1973, a U.S.-backed coup. There was the Reagan-led U.S. invasion of tiny Grenada in the Caribbean when they tried to take a progressive path. And then each time, Medea, there's always some non-colonialist explanation, some noble cause assigned to these interventions by the coup makers. And then you have the U.S. mainstream media, no matter what, even though it rejects the old coups from the 1950s or 1960s, sort of echoing the same colorful, demonizing language that's used as a justification for the current coup. That's why I think it's so important that the people actually sort of think skeptically about those kind of media reports, and even more importantly, do something to say, hey, this government does not speak with our consent. Go ahead.
Well, that's right. And it's also so important to do it at the OAS, because the OAS for so many years has been used by the United States to justify its intervention. The ones that you mentioned were pretty much all supported by the OAS. And now the OAS is quite divided. I think it's 16 out of 34 countries that have gone with Guaido as the, quote, president. But there is a lot of dissent within there as well. So we want to show that even within the United States, there are voices of opposition. And I think the most important thing we can do right now is to be getting our Congress people to speak out. I'm on my way to Congress right now. We've been walking the halls yesterday afternoon. We'll do it today to say, why aren't you speaking out? How can you justify U.S. military intervention in Latin America and see that this could lead to a tremendously violent civil war? We've got to stop that before it happens.
One thing, John, that seems to have changed is with the expression of support for Maduro from the military and other elements of the Venezuelan government, it seems like right now the coup, it's not over. The coup effort is not over. They're going to use every tactic. But right now, it seems like momentum has slowed a little bit, and perhaps the Trump administration, fed by its own imperial fantasy, was assuming that Venezuelans would just, you know, throw open the doors and say, yes, this is it. We're going to finally embrace America the way they maybe expected the Iraqis to do the same in 2003. Doesn't seem to be happening.
No, but I do think they're trying to create a parallel government, and the way they are saying that Guaido is now the president, we're not going to listen to whatever Maduro says. We're not going to even allow Venezuela to money to be coming from the United States to the Maduro government. It's going to go to some parallel government. I mean, they're scheming all kinds of very vile things to create more of a crisis.
Indeed. Make the economy scream.
Medea, what can the average person do to protest this imperialist action? Is there anything that's organized yet?
Yeah, I mean, sure. With ANSWER, we are organizing the protests on Saturday, tomorrow at 1 o'clock in front of the White House. But there are also protests that ANSWER is doing all over the country. And we're telling people to call their congresspeople, 202-224-3121. But also to join us by going to your congresspeople, either locally or here in Washington, D.C., to say to them that we elected you to do something about these kinds of crises and that we want to hear from you. It's not enough to say that you resist Donald Trump. Let us see what that really means. And we want you to put out statements to introduce pieces of legislation, at the very minimum, tweets saying that you don't agree with this policy. And right now, there's only a handful of Congress people that have been doing that. The Progressive Caucus in Congress is the largest caucus that there is, and they should all be doing something. They say they are, but it's taking too long. And before we know it, this coup will be in full gear, and they will still be deliberating about what kind of language they want to use for their resolution. So, yes, there's lots of things that we can be doing, and we should be doing them quickly.
And what are you hearing from Venezuelans on the street? Are they worried about violence spiraling out of control? Do they think that the Maduro government will be able to assert itself? What are they saying?
Well, I talked to friends in Venezuela yesterday, and they really are very nervous. You know, they've been suffering so much with the economic crisis, and now to think, and people are dying on the streets of Venezuela with protests of the two different sides confronting each other. And this has even affected families with divisions internally inside families. So it's, and they're worrying about it spiraling out of control. So yes, people are very worried inside Venezuela. They also think that there is a real chance that the U.S. would do some kind of crazy military intervention, given how strong the wording of Trump and Pence and Bolton has been. So great concern within Venezuela.
That would undoubtedly have to be the case. Again, just think about it, Medea. The U.S. government, which is promoting democracy, it says it's doing everything in the name of democracy, is actually trying to promote a civil war inside Venezuela. That's what they actually want, because only through civil war, it would seem, will the United States realize its dream of overthrowing Maduro and stopping the Bolivarian process and putting into power in Venezuela, like what they've done in Honduras or earlier in Chile or in other Latin American countries now, a government that would be basically very, very friendly to the United States, promoting civil war.
Well, that's right. And I think, unfortunately, most people in this country are either consumed by the domestic issues that are very severe as well, but also don't have a memory of what has been the aftermath of U.S. interventions. I mean, maybe they think that Latin America is very different from the Middle East, and these kind of things happen over there in the Middle East, but, you know, won't happen in Latin America. Well, there's been so much death and destruction from the wars that the U.S. has pushed in Latin America that we should be really, really worried about what the effects could be if indeed a civil war breaks out. The U.S. is trying very hard to divide the military in Venezuela. We know that. And we know that there are a lot of armed opposition people because we've seen it at the demonstrations. So I just urge anybody who's listening not to take this lightly and to get involved, do something, join us either on the streets or in the halls of Congress. And if people want to reach me, they can email me at Medea@codepink.org and come and join us in Washington, D.C. or in your home district, getting the Congress people to try to check the terrible policies of the Trump administration.
Okay, that was the voice of Medea Benjamin, who joined us from Washington. Medea is an anti-war and anti-torture activist who's also the co-founder of Code Pink. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Marzia Hashemi, the American citizen who is a journalist for Iran's Press TV, was released from federal custody after testifying before a grand jury. Hashemi had been held without charge as a material witness to force her testimony. She was subject to a variety of degradations while being held. Marzia Hashemi joins us from Washington. Welcome to the show, Marzia.
Thank you so much, John and Brian. Great to be with you guys.
We're very happy to have you. Can we start off by asking you then to explain just how this whole thing started?
Well, I just finished up making a documentary in St. Louis and trying to return from St. Louis to go to Denver, where two of my kids live and my grandkids. I was waiting for my flight at the gate. There were more than usual TSA agents at the gate, And let me say that whenever I travel in the United States, first, when I enter the United States, it's sheer hell. And also when I leave, but when I travel on domestic flights inside of the U.S., I'm always subjected to, I have to be there at least 3 to 3.5 hours prior to flight time in order to make any flight, because that's how much I'm hassled along the way. So I am accustomed to the last stop right before getting on the plane at the gate, that there, again, TSA agents are sent there to harass me again and say they have to search all over. This is after going through TSA. So I am used to seeing the TSA agents be put at the door of any gate that I'm going to be going through to get on the flight. But this time it was even more than usual. So I knew something was up. I was called to the desk. My name was called, and they asked me to come to the desk. I went there, and the agent there working, she said, you've been selected to pre-board. I'm like, okay, this should be interesting. I've never heard of a
never heard of such a
selection. But hey, you know, I guess I'm the first one that this is happening to. Anyway, I was with my son, Reza, and the two of us were going, you know, gave him our boarding passes, and we're going down the corridor. And then when we turned the corner to actually enter the last hall before the plane, that's where FBI agents were standing and waiting, and said my name, and, you know, you're coming with us, you're detained. And I said, am I under arrest? And one of the FBI agents, she says, yes, you are.
Oh, boy.
Yes. And I turned, I said, is my son under arrest? And they said, no. And I turned to him. I mean, this was at the same time they had handcuffed me and they're pulling me off. And I turned to Reza and I said, get on the plane to Denver. Just get on the plane to Denver. Of course, that didn't happen because FBI agents were with him the whole night also, and then flew him also to Washington the following day. Anyway, that night, the agents stayed. It was a hotel they put me at which they were with me the whole time. And then early in the morning on, that would be Monday morning. I don't know dates right now. Still, I'm kind of just not back to normal.
Sure.
But Monday morning, was flown to Washington, D.C., handcuffed the whole time, let me just say, and arrived in D.C., taken straight to FBI headquarters. That's when they were telling me that this is in conjunction with the material witness, and I'm not being charged with a crime. But, and then they started taking my fingerprints and said that they were going to take my DNA. I protested.
Your DNA?
Yes, my DNA. I protested. I said, I don't want my DNA taken. And they said, it must be. And I said, I don't want it taken. And they said, everyone coming through this door, the DNA is taken. I said, no, I won't. But my DNA was taken, fingerprinted. I was there a couple of hours. And then they transferred me by shackles and to the van that took me to Central, I believe, lockup or whatever. I'm not even sure exactly where I was. But then they were processing again. So again, fingerprints, mug shots. They told me to take off my scarf. I'm a Muslim woman. I wear hijab. I said, no, I can't take off my scarf. And they said, you must take off your scarf. And I said, but it's illegal. I have the right to keep my scarf on. I'm a Muslim woman. I have religious freedom. And they said, you have to take your scarf off for the mug shot. So the mug shot was taken without my scarf on. After that, they allowed me to put it back on. I was taken and put into a cell, very dark, cold type place, and, you know, the toilet in the middle of the floor. And of course, you could see it from the you know, other cells in the hallway where the guards are walking. And the guards were men and women, and they were passing regularly. There were also men in the other cells there. So it wasn't a separate section just for women, but my cell, I was the only person there, so I was not in a cell with anyone at that point in time. Then tried to sleep, whatever, you know, there that night, because we were there all night on some kind of iron cot or iron bench or whatever. And then early in the morning, the guards come. And, of course, during the night, there's all kind of, you know, people coming in, screaming, yelling, all kind of things going on. When the guards come in the morning, they say, okay, get up for court, everyone, get up for court. And then they started getting everyone together, depending on the court that the individuals were going to. They were taken accordingly. The majority of them left before me. They were all shackled and taken away. And because I guess I was going to a different court, I left a little bit later, maybe 30 minutes or so. And then, again, I was shackled and then taken to the first court hearing that I had. I went there. That's when I met the lawyer, the court-appointed lawyer, for the first time. And I still had not been allowed to contact my kids or anyone, and I hadn't talked to a lawyer up until this point in time.
You know, we should remind our listeners, too, that you were never accused of a crime. This was a material witness warrant, and yet you were still treated like a criminal. You had your DNA forcibly extracted from you, and you were subject to mugshots and handcuffs and detention in a cell.
And leg shackles and connecting the two.
Oh, you got the full treatment.
Yes, and flown to Washington, D.C. While handcuffed, not allowed to go to the bathroom during that flight. So, yes, I was never charged with the crime. After that hearing, they, again, took me into the prison van. Okay, of course, again, this is shackles and everything. And, you know, it's all kind of people, too, in the van. You go in mass when they transfer you, I guess, from the central, from the courtroom to, then I was put in another prison, and that's where I was the rest of the time. Upon entering there, that's when I was strip searched, and we have which would be traumatic for anyone, for a Muslim woman who I wear a scarf and try to dress modestly. One must realize how difficult and how degrading this whole process was. After that, I was given prison clothing, the orange scrubs, short sleeves. I was told I could not put my scarf back on my head. I told them I had to cover my head, and they said, no, we'll give you a scarf later on, but at this point, you cannot. You cannot wear your own clothing. You cannot wear that scarf. I asked if they had long sleeves. They said no, because I wear long sleeves outside. Again, for the mugshot, another mugshot and fingerprint, they said I could not put anything on my head. And I said, please just give me something that I can wear for this mugshot. And they said, absolutely not. And I said, listen, what you're doing is against the law. It is my right as a Muslim woman and religious right and freedom to be able to wear my scarf for this mugshot. And the guard said, absolutely not. So another mugshot was taken without my scarf. Then one of the guards, after the mugshot, she says, here, take a T-shirt. It was a white T-shirt. She said, you can cover your head with this, at least, trying to show some compassion. So she gave me that. I tried to put it on my head. And actually, she tried to help me put it on my head, this one particular guard. Then I go through processing, the other part of the processing, which men and women are together, inmates and guards. So I had the T-shirt on my head while I was going through that process, which took a while.
We're joined by Marzia Hashemi. She's joining us from Washington. We're going to continue this conversation in a moment, so stay tuned.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Marzia Hashemi, the American citizen who's a journalist for Iran's Press TV, was released from federal custody after testifying before a grand jury. This is the second part of our interview with her. She was just discussing a guard giving her a T-shirt to cover her head in lieu of her hijab that they'd stripped her of. Marzia, please continue.
After that, when it was time for the guards to take us to the different sections of male, female, and the individual units, the guard told me, okay, you have to take the T-shirt off your head. And I said, why? And she said, because you can't walk through the halls with a T-shirt on your head. And I said, but I could sit here. I mean, I came in here with a scarf. So if you give me my scarf, which is best, I would prefer. But even now you're telling me I can't even keep a T-shirt on my head. She says, no, you cannot. And I said, but I need to at least keep this on my head. And she said, absolutely not, you're not. And again, that was not allowed. And I went down the hall into, of course, that's where men and women are together in these different sections. And she said, when you get to the women's section, you can put the T-shirt back on your head. So that is what happened. And I kept saying, okay, they said that there are scarves. wear the scarf. Can someone give me a scarf? And I said, well, it takes time. You have to be processed and whatever, you know, it takes a while. So I was put in a cell by myself. And basically the majority of the time that I was there, I was in solitary. There were a couple of days that actually even they had me on suicide watch. There was a chair right outside my cell, and the guard was there the whole night. I mean, I thought it was odd, like, why is she sitting there? But I didn't know what exactly was going on until the next day I found out from other prisoners when we were being transferred to go back to court. They started talking, and they were like, one of them started asking, are you okay or whatever? And I said, well, like, I'm all right, as okay as I can be in this situation. And they start telling me that, because you're on suicide watch. And I'm like, what?
Oh, boy.
And they're like, yeah, because the guards were telling us last night that they had to stay there. They couldn't move. They had to watch you, and because you're on suicide watch. And I can tell you that it made me think, like, you know, well, what's going on and possibilities of things that could happen. So actually, one of the prisoners, she was going to a hearing, and then she was supposed to be released that day. And I talked to her and I said, listen, is there any way that you can call this number? I gave her my daughter's number and I said, just let my daughter know what you just told me about the suicide watch. And just let her know if anything happens to me, she knows that I didn't commit suicide. So things were on this kind of a level for me, not knowing what's going to happen next. And because when you have been put in this kind of position, you feel that anything can happen. And I really felt that at this point in time, anything can happen. I could be released, I felt, the next day, or I could end up getting years in prison or life imprisonment or even losing my life.
Marzia, I wanna jump in here on this, and time is going a little bit short, but I think that's such an important thing. I was reading a transcript of an interview with you, I believe, in the last day or so since you've been released after being compelled under these conditions to testify before the grand jury. And you said, what I realize is how easy it is for them to make someone disappear. If my son was not there, anything could have happened to me and no one would have known where I was. And I'm just wondering how many people that this happens to. You're a journalist. If it happens to you, you're a well-known journalist. I mean, people all over the world know you. They've seen your show. You're well-recognized. You're rooted here in U.S. society. You're an American citizen. You were in St. Louis making a documentary. You have family here. You know, you sort of go into this netherworld with the state and the coercive institutions of the state taking you there. Because time is a little bit short, I wanted to ask you, was there any effort by the FBI or the U.S. government to get you to testify other than grabbing you, seizing you, depriving you of your rights, and subjecting you to this kind of treatment?
Absolutely not. And that was my argument. And I told my lawyer to make that argument. I said, no way, nowhere, if they look at my character, personality, could they have said that I would not appear for a subpoena. No, they did not subpoena me. They did not try.
Didn't even try. Yeah.
They didn't even try because the FBI had been, when I come and go, usually either up and entering the states or leaving the states, they have questioned me several times. And I have cooperated with them. I have actually sat down at the airport and we talked. So they couldn't say that I wasn't cooperative. Or I had shown in the past that I wouldn't work with them as far as them asking a question and me not answering. They didn't even try. They said, flight risk. What kind of flight risk? My roots are here. Yes, I work and I live in Iran right now. But my children, two of my children, all of my grandkids are here. My brothers are here. I have family here. I'm definitely going to come and go to the United States. I am American. So what does that mean, a flight risk, that I'm not going to even want to come back here again? And why, when I haven't committed a crime, why would I do that? Based on what? Who gives them that prerogative to make that decision, kidnap me, take my freedom away, shackle me, subject me to all kinds of unbelievable things because they felt, is this where we have come in American society?
Let me just ask you a follow-up question to that. Given what you just said in the fact that you would obviously not be a flight risk and obviously been willing to testify under these, with the grand jury. And given that you would have done that, and yet they didn't even seek to have you do that, and they subjected you to this unbelievable degradation and the negation of your basic human rights, your basic democratic rights, your constitutional rights, why do you think they did that?
Intimidation, Ryan. I think that it's intimidation and it sets an example for others. Don't make waves. Don't make waves because anything can happen to you. I mean, that's the overall message, I believe. I guess they didn't look at, they didn't do a good enough case study in dealing with me. I'm not an individual who's afraid. I've always stood up for others' rights and for the oppressed in general and for what is right, no matter the ramifications. So it's mind-boggling to me that they would actually choose me to do this too. But because I am American and because I live in Iran, I mean, that's all part of it. So I'm caught up in between these worlds and entities in 40 years of sanctions, of course, on the Islamic Republic of Iran and actually getting worse now by the day. So all part of that game that they thought that they could get away with it. And this is the problem, Brian, is that people have been intimidated. People have become less active in just standing up against these transgressions. But what I was saying to everyone, and actually today, Friday, there are worldwide demonstrations that were going to be held and trying to demand my freedom. When I got out and I realized that, I asked everyone to continue with the demonstrations because it's not about me. It's about not allowing this to happen to anyone. I had the media connection and this got out. What about the average Joe, John, Ali on the street that this could happen to at any time and no one would know? No one would know. And then, of course, then all of a sudden it's sealed. It's sealed. So you won't even get any information from the courts. No, this cannot happen. We cannot allow this to go on.
We are speaking with Marzia Hashemi. She is a journalist for Press TV who just went through a terrible experience that really no American should ever have to endure. Brian, this is entirely consistent with other such stories that we've heard.
Yeah, and I think Marzia is making the most important point that this was not necessary. Of course, it's not legal, but it wasn't even from any point of view necessary. What they were trying to do was to intimidate her, to intimidate others, to tell other people, don't you dare come against the U.S. government by even talking about the truth, by telling the truth, by being part of alternative media, by trying to make documentaries about race, the epidemic of racist police violence in America. It's an intimidation tactic. Thankfully for us, meaning the people here who care about our rights and who care about justice, people of conscience, Marzia was the wrong target because she's not intimidated. But also the point that she's making that she was in a unique position because she is connected to the media and because her son was there, we know what actually happened. But there are a lot of people who don't know what's happening to them. Thus, we must all do as she has done, which is to stand strong. 30 seconds left, Marzia, take us out.
Well, and actually, the demonstration is being held, again, as I said, throughout the world today. There's a demonstration going to be in Washington, D.C. at 3 p.m. I will be there. I will address people there. It is important. Everyone must know you have to stand up. You must stand against this type of oppression and stand for freedom. And no way that someone can tell me that to take someone, kidnap someone, incarcerate them illegally and put them through all of this that and with them not even being charged. I don't think that this is the America that Americans want.
We're joined by Marzia Hashemi. She is a journalist for Press TV, and she joined us from Washington. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again, this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt, He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And you can find also the worst headlines that we don't have time to get to today. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we're joined here in the studio by Nicole Roussel. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, y'all.
Delighted to join you.
Well, there's a lot of news today. So let's start with one of the most obvious, Steve, and that is the coup in Venezuela.
I like this headline because it indicates that Maduro's not happy.
Right.
He's not happy about the coup. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, actually, this is one of the interesting cases of a changing headline. The original headline from the New York Times, which I thought was very dishonest, outraged Maduro, cuts ties with U.S. after opposition leader declares himself Venezuela's president. Well, which is very dishonest because he didn't cut ties with the U.S. because Guaido declared himself president. He cut ties with the U.S. because the U.S. recognized this illegal declaration. Now, the interesting thing is, the following day, that was yesterday's headline. Today, if you go to that story, the headline now reads correctly, after U.S. backs Juan Guaido as Venezuela's leader, Maduro cuts ties. So again, thanks to presumably pressure from people like me and no doubt lots of others, they realized their headline was totally dishonest and actually changed it.
They realized it initially because they wrote it in a bad way on purpose. They changed it because of pressure from you and from other people. They knew what they were doing.
This happens almost every week, it seems, that some news outlet changes because of pressure on Twitter or from, you know
I never even noticed that happened until we started talking about it.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised at how routine it is for these outlets to go back and change headlines.
But it's also another version of the retraction syndrome, because the first version is the version that sticks, the wrong version, the one that's deliberately concocted to be wrong and to give a misleading impression.
I do want to say, while this segment is called headlines, the worst aspect of the media coverage of what's happening in Venezuela hasn't been the headlines so much as the media, the picture coverage and on TV, the video coverage. There have been huge demonstrations by the opposition, and there have also been huge demonstrations by pro-government Maduro supporter forces. But all of the latter has been completely blanked out by the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and ABC and everyone, really. All the mainstream media, you will be, unless you go to Venezuela Analysis or places like that, you will simply not see pictures of the huge demonstrations by government supporters, which is really as dishonest as any.
It doesn't fit the narrative.
And earlier in the show, Jackie Lukman, who we have on every Friday for our segment In the News, was comparing photos of, you know, both the National Assembly and the National Constituent Assembly, which, you know, one is an illegal body that had some illegal activity going on. And that's the one that Guaido came from and said that he was, you know, president from that body. And the National Constituent Assembly is the group that has been elected by the people to look at the Constitution. And the National Constituent Assembly looks just like the pro-Maduro marches have looked, which is working class people, people of color. And the National Assembly looks just like the opposition, which is the wealthier folks, the whiter folks in that country. And it's just, the photos are really astounding when you compare.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's go to the worst headline, single worst headline to come out of the Venezuela crisis so far. And this is a Wall Street Journal editorial. And here's the headline: Cuba out of Venezuela. Friends of democracy need to target Havana's control in Caracas. And so with flagrant, you know, U.S. intervention going on in Venezuela, the Wall Street Journal thinks it's Cuban intervention that's the problem. It's really astonishing. They actually, there's this sentence in the editorial that says, Cuba is the imperial power in Caracas.
I think this is the first time I've ever heard Cuba, an island country of about 13 million, declared to be an imperialist power. That's interesting. So, yeah. Yankee in, Cuba out. Maybe that could be the slogan of the Wall Street Journal.
They even bring in Russia. Steve, you highlighted another sentence. Russia certainly wouldn't mind a Syrian-style civil war in Venezuela that would spread more chaos in the Americas and more opportunity to undermine democratic governments.
Wait. This Russians, who are the allies of Maduro, want to avoid a civil war because Maduro is the constitutional power. America, Steve Pett, is actually promoting civil war.
Yes, this editorial is absolutely delusional. That's the only word for it. Well, speaking of Russia, it's time to turn to Russia, our weekly Russia headlines.
Somebody's got to do it, Steve.
Yeah. DNC says it was targeted again by Russian hackers after the 2018 election. Now, why they'd be targeted after the election is never made clear in this article. But the interesting thing, again, this is from the New York Times. By the time you get to the 11th paragraph, you can read the following. FireEye, that's one of these security firms, said that although Cozy Bear, the alleged Russians, was the likeliest culprit, the firm could not firmly establish who was responsible for the 2018 campaign against the DNC. And CrowdStrike, another cybersecurity firm, also said it could not definitively say that Cozy Bear was to blame. So after we got the headline about Russian hackers and targeting the DNC, by the time you get to the 11th paragraph, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. They don't really know.
John, I've always suspected that Putin and the Russian intelligence was so clever that they would start to meddle in our democracy after the election.
Yes, yes, after the election.
They're going on a different calendar, you know.
Yeah. Go ahead, Steve.
Here's a series of headlines in another part of the world. This is from Syria. And a series of headlines on the latest Israeli strike there. And you'll notice something interesting about this series of headlines from CNN. Israel strikes Iranian targets in Damascus. New York Times. Israel confirms attacks on Iranian targets. Washington Post. Israel makes rare admission of striking Iranian forces. Now, here's the interesting thing about this. There is absolutely no proof other than the Israeli claiming that they were targeting Iranian targets, that they did target Iranian forces. So all these headlines, just take the Israelis' word for it. They could say Israel claims it struck Iranian targets. That would be, you know, an okay headline. But just writing headlines that say Israel strikes Iranian targets, which puts into people's minds that this is a fact rather than an assertion by Israel, is just plain wrong. And especially because if you read the reports, there's only four people who were supposedly killed, and they were all Syrian servicemen.
They and their families didn't know that they were actually Iranian.
Apparently. So this is just an illustration of how Israeli point of view just becomes the point of view of the U.S. press.
And John, you'll remember we talked to Mohammed Mirandi from Iran. He's an academic there. He said Israel is actually not striking Iranian targets in Syria, that there have actually been continually striking Syrian targets. But in order to justify it, they always call them Iranian targets. But he asserts that they're not striking Iranian, quote, Iranian targets at all.
Yeah. And you know what? I think he's right, because if there were Iranian targets in Western, especially Southwestern Syria, near Israel, this would be on the front page of every American newspaper every day. This would be a direct and immediate threat to Israel. At least that's how the press would see it. And we never read about stuff like that.
And also the other headline that you have here, Steve, Israel strikes Iranian targets in Damascus after missile fired at Golan Heights. Now, Golan Heights was seized by Israel in the 1967 war. Golan Heights is part of Syria. It's always been part of Syria. So the Israelis seize it. They say, well, a missile was fired. So they struck back. But at whom? Not Syrians, but against Iranian targets, which also ends up being the Damascus airport. Anyway, let's keep going.
Should we move on to the Roger Stone headlines?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, so Roger Stone was in court today. He was indicted. And so, you know, we've talked already in the show quite a bit about this, but there's one headline that we wanted to talk about. It's in the Washington Post, and it's a little bit further down. You know, there's a bunch of kind of bigger headlines about Roger Stone, but this is a nice wrap up. Who has been charged in Russia probe and why? Roger Stone has become one of 35 people, including 26 Russian nationals, who have been charged in the ongoing investigation.
Wait, this indictment of Roger Stone does not mention Russia. It is Robert Mueller. I thought the headline would be like megalomaniacal psychopath Roger Stone, trickster, fraudster, tried to insert himself in 2016 campaign by telling Trump campaign officials that he had information about WikiLeaks when he had none, but they wouldn't return his call. No, that's too long for a headline.
There's an even better one in The Hill, a newspaper. It's former attorney general, : there's a reason FBI arrested Stone fully armed, but the reason's not clear yet.
Wait, they stormed his apartment. He was in his bathrobe. He knew he was going to get indicted, but the FBI, John, you did a perfect impersonation of the FBI. It was like, we are the FBI.
Yeah, they bang on the door, FBI, open up, warrant, FBI. And then they break the door
down. And then a few hours later, he's out on $250,000 signature bond.
Signature bond, which means no money had to change hands.
Okay, last headline, Steve.
Let's go with a humorous one. FBI in shutdown. We can't pay informants. At last, we had something to like about the shutdown.
I'm just guessing this is also not true, but it is a funny headline. What do you think about it, John?
I think it's nonsense, because if the FBI is anything like the CIA, there is cash, millions of dollars in cash sitting on pallets in locked rooms. There's plenty of cash to pay their informants. Well, we were happy to have Steve Patt. Steve joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. You can find that at lefteye.blogspot.com. And you can also find there all the headlines that we didn't have a chance to get to. We were also joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.
Oh,